I could see professionals there and those who are not. But to put it all together is a very fine achievement. The subject today I have given before in another congregation and was asked to present it here sometime previously. A change of schedule occurred, and consequently we have the topic today on a significant weekend. I hope you take note of the fact that our society would not be what it is today, and the church would not be what it is, if there had never been a July 3rd or a July 4th. Actually, the 4th was the day that was chosen, though it was not necessarily the day of the particular event we mean to commemorate as far as the signatories go. I want to address the question of the origin and the nature, the background of the work of which we are a part, or if you please, the history of the function of the worldwide Church of God and how we came to be where we are, a worldwide work. And I'll just take a moment and point up that we are around the world in so brief a time as little more than half a century, from the mid-1930s to the mid-1980s in the lifespan of one person, and continuing another generation through publishing, through radio, through television. But when this land was first settled by individuals from different parts of the British Isles and other areas, if we were to trace the view of publishing, radio, and television, we would find that the mother country of our primary culture and language, the British Isles, is not a land of the radio free or the television free. Now, of course, we pay for time. But radio is not free to be paid for with respect to time in terms as we know it. There never would have been a World Tomorrow program, either on radio or on television, if this country had not been independent. To this day, we have never been on an independent station functioning as a British station, but something elsewhere, in Luxembourg, on a ship at sea. Some other means of communication to the British Isles. So on a weekend such as this, we might give some special thanks for the God who foresaw what had to be done, whether it was justified at the time, I am not taking a stance on. I am sure Prince Charles would have another view than those who signed the Declaration of Independence. Nevertheless, out of whatever mistakes may have been made across the seas, looking east or west, a nation arose with a sense of individual responsibilities and freedom that allows us the good and the evil. There are nations who do not permit themselves the kind of evils we allow in this land in terms of crime of all sorts. They simply have restrained themselves. In fact, no other major civilized nation permits what we permit. And at the same time, there is no other great nation of the population that we have that would have made possible what has been achieved by the church in these 5 to 6 decades. We have, of course, in a certain sense, heavily influenced our neighbor to the north. But the British view in Britain is much more restrained than the Canadian view, where a certain measure of the sense of freedom, as we know it in this country, has taken root there, and we are able to communicate by way of stations in Canada to Canada. So we need to be very thankful for that. The purpose of the sermon today was to tell you items that are important in putting together a story, but not a story that you couldn't read on your own and would have to read merely from notes. So what I have done is to choose the late edition, not one of the earliest, of the autobiography of Herbert W. Armstrong, Volume 1. And I will read to you the events that happened so you will understand the nature of the work that began in the 1930s. For there are people who today and tomorrow, as well as yesterday, will decide to do what they wish to do and do not have a sense of what it means to be the collective work of the church under the direction of Jesus Christ. People who cannot bury their personal wishes when indeed there is a higher order and calling. This is a collective work. This is not the work of every individual doing his or her own thing. And because it is a collective work, we have accomplished what has been done through the power of the Spirit of God working in and through all levels in the church, which could not have been done if there had been no pattern of organization, no channeling of our efforts, no planning, no development of programs to meet the specific periods of time through which the church has passed. Necessarily, what is today and what was in the 70s, what was in the 50s, and what was in the 30s would be a different world. And so we have to recognize that we didn't start out on television, we didn't have satellites to beam the program, we didn't have color printing available, we didn't have the computer system as we have today to take care of a gigantic mailing list. Everything was simpler. For those who sang in the chorale, this work essentially began in the time of the Great Depression or of the birth of those who presented the chorale program in the age of their grandparents. In other words, 2 generations have elapsed since this work. For some of you, you were already here, but that number is very small. There is a woman in the last Festival of Tabernacles that my wife and I observed in Eugene, Oregon, who was baptized in 1928. Now that gives you some perspective with respect to how long there are people who have survived in health and responsibility and loyalty. She is still here. She has commented on those who've come and gone, that they did not ever apparently see the big picture or saw too much of themselves in the picture. Anyway, you should know what events transpired. The Churches of God's Seventh Day were not organized in the 1920s as the worldwide Church of God came to be organized to do the work that has been accomplished. And we need to learn a little bit about the difference and what the brethren in those days understood and what that would mean in terms of how this work developed. The way to take notes is not to try to summarize what I am saying unless I give an aside. I will simply tell you the page, where it will be found in the paragraph, and all you have to do is simply write the page number and the paragraph number. That will be your format. It's the simplest way. Then you can read the material yourself. There may be some thoughts that you'll want to have highlighted, but otherwise, that's the best way to describe what I am presenting today. And then you can go back and you will have it all in front of you in the volume with the picture on the cover in a duotone. The numbering of the pages will vary somewhat in earlier editions. The Autobiography of Herbert W. Armstrong, Volume 1, or Why We Are Here Today. On pages 311 and 312, we have the background of the story where I should like to begin. Sometimes I will simply mention to you the area, rather than specific paragraphs. It'll be under a subhead. This material is the life and death struggle. That is the story of repentance of a man who came from the Quakers, who had married a woman who was involved with the Methodist Church, who had come to know brethren, in particular the Runcorn family, who brought to her attention some simple things in the Bible that Loma D. Armstrong grasped immediately. This life and death struggle, it meant real repentance, for now I saw that I had been breaking God's law. I had been rebelling against God. It meant turning around and going the way of God, the way of His Bible, living according to every word in the Bible instead of the ways of society or the desires of the flesh and vanity. That's the introduction here to the life and death struggle. It's a story that involves the baptism of Herbert W. Armstrong. Now we'll move along just to pick up our theme, because you need to know what was happening step by step, or why someone from the outside came to be both writer and speaker within the Churches of God Seventh Day. Page 319 now. The bottom of this page, the last paragraph, page 319, the bottom of the page, to paragraph 2 on 320. We're moving from one page to another. Immediately upon coming up out of the water, I definitely experienced a change in attitude and in mind generally. I had already repented and surrendered to God's rule over my life. The natural hostility to God and His law already had gone. Yet now, for the first time, I felt clean. I knew now that the terribly heavy load of sin had been taken off my shoulders. Christ had paid the penalty for me. All past sins were now blotted out by His blood. My conscience was clean and clear. For the first time in my life, I experienced real inner peace of mind. I realized as never before how futile and useless and foolish are the ways of this world on which most people set so much store. There was a quiet happiness of mind in the sure knowledge that now I was actually a son of God. I could really call God Father. We'll skip to page 353. We'll look at paragraph 2. And of course, paragraph 1 will always be the new one on the page, not the one continuing at the top. That's how we number. 353, paragraph 2. Mr. Armstrong had examined Sabbath-keeping groups and Sunday-keeping groups for a while, you know, with that subject. Having understood the commandments of God, he said that automatically ruled out all churches observing Sunday in terms of those who should be obedient. We're not talking about individuals who were in churches being called of God, the individuals. We're talking about a church made up of those who are called and doing the work collectively. For many of you, but not all, came out of denominations. There are many who came out earlier and then heard us. So we're not dealing with the question of when God calls individuals and in what organizations, but what they do after they have been called, whether they are really submissive or only have their own view. That automatically ruled out all churches observing Sunday. As far as I could learn, it reduced the search to 3 small groups: the Seventh-day Adventists, the Seventh-day Baptists, and a little almost unheard of church called the Church of God, which maintained a small publishing headquarters in Stanbury, Missouri. In 1947, I came to Ambassador College. I had known of Seventh-day Adventists. I was aware of Seventh-day Baptists. I had never heard of the Church of God Seventh-day with headquarters in Stanbury, Missouri. Now, I'm sure if I had searched, I would have, because it was accessible in terms of information in some list. But that illustrates the remarkable experience that the people of God were so few, so small, and accomplishing in the 1920s and early 30s so little that they were essentially unknown. To backtrack to the time of Abraham Lincoln, Lincoln is the only president of record who was not a member of a church. I assume some of you or most of you do know that. When asked about that, he said, "When I find a group of people who not only have the Ten Commandments on the wall, but keep them, then I will give due thought to being a part of an organization that you call a church." But he hadn't found any group that did what they said they were supposed to do. Lincoln became president in 1861. The Churches of God Seventh Day were not organized until into the time of the Civil War, and Lincoln was dead at 1865. Essentially, he would have had at most access to Volume 1 or Volume 2 of the earliest published material of the Church. He never did know as a person what that group was like, even though it came to the attention of the federal government of the United States that there was such an organization as the Church of God Seventh Day, for members of that church did not participate in the Civil War, as the Seventh Day Baptists did participate in the War of Independence in the previous century. Anyway, with this study, Mr. Armstrong came to examine further. On page 354, paragraph 3, of the churches to which the search had been narrowed, only one had the name of the true church. That was the small, little herd of Church of God with headquarters at Stanbury, Missouri. Now, If you've ever wanted to find Stanbury on the map, you'll want definitely one of the impressive maps, because Stanbury is also a small town. It meant something in the 1860s. There's probably one service station in the community. That's my memory of it when I once visited it in 1968. It's a very small town. The churches of God in those days were found in the countryside in numerous states, the towns, but not the great cities. This work had a reason for being first in Eugene, Oregon, and then in Pasadena, California, a city in the United States known around the world. First for the Rose Parade, and finally for what is not in Pasadena, NASA JPL. Pasadena didn't want something like that. Now La Cañada Flint Ridge has it, but we still like to think of it as in Pasadena. But it is not. But that's why this area is known, and that's why it is important that the worldwide Church of God, wherever the headquarters would be in a place that has recognition. So the question went further. Mr. Armstrong searched and examined. We'll take a look now at page 356. The last line, the new paragraph at the bottom of the page, bottom, page 356, to the middle of page 357 and the new heading. I was deeply perplexed. Here was a little church with scattered members, speaking of the United States, probably numbering less than 2,000, mostly in rural areas. Apparently, as nearly as I could learn, it had only a very limited number of local churches, none as large as 100 members. As I began to come in contact with some of its leaders, they seemed to be men of little education, no college degrees. Only one man had more professional education in terms of academics than Mr. Armstrong himself, Mr. A.N. Duggar. Its ministry could hardly be described as an educated ministry. Their preaching had a certain fire, yet seemed to lack the power that attracts sizable audiences, that moves people, stirs hearts, and changes lives. I could see no visible results. Now, there had been earlier significant results, I would say probably around the turn of the century into the early 1920s. Could this be God's one and only true church on earth? The very question seemed preposterous. But where else? And then Mr. Armstrong continues with a description of the fact that however limited they seemed to be, here was a people keeping the commandments of God and having the testimony that Jesus Christ brought, the good news. Could such a church, imperfect, feeble, lacking in any sizable accomplishment, be the true church of God? Could this be Christ's instrument? He asks at the bottom of page 357. An interesting sentence. Was a question in his mind. Page 358, paragraph 3. I began to fellowship with their scattered and few members in Oregon, while at the same time refraining from acknowledging membership. Now he was baptized, not by someone in the Church of God Seventh Day. He was fellowshipping with the scattered members in Oregon, in the Willamette Valley. But he did not formally acknowledge membership. He was living at the time in Portland, by the way. Now we'll move on to 359, paragraphs 2 and 3. Having been a trained magazine and advertising copywriter, the results of these studies were written up purely for my own benefit in article form. My wife began showing these articles to some women members of the Church of God who lived in Salem. Soon they began to urge me to preach before them. But becoming a preacher was the very last thing I had ever wanted to do. I felt a distinct aversion to the idea. Meanwhile, on their urging, a few of my articles had been mailed to the Bible Advocate in Stanberry, Missouri, which was under the general editorial leadership of Mr. A.N. Duggar, whose granddaughter, by the way, is a minister's wife in the worldwide church. These articles began appearing on the front page. Now, I would like to mention briefly as an aside, which you might like to put in your notes, Mr. Duggar respected, because he was reasonably well educated with a certain college training, but no degree. And he recognized good writing, and he made certain decisions to put this kind of material on the front page or in the Bible Advocate. And Mr. Armstrong regarded Mr. A.N. Duggar as, in fact, the leader in the church. I will use the word in. The leader of the church is Christ. But the leader in the church here was clearly this man, Mr. A.N. Duggar. The family goes back before his generation in the church. So now, while attending, Mr. Armstrong's material came to the attention of the church leadership and of members and began to appear. Page 363. We'll start with this page in paragraph 1. It goes on at some length to page 364, paragraph 3. The subject is preaching. So whether I read all of it or not, it's the material as a whole under the area, my first sermon. Paragraph 1, under the heading, my first sermon. And the story continues all the way through 364, page 3. We are now in the year 1928. Mr. Armstrong had studied in 1926, been baptized in 1927. Now we are in 1928. The Great Depression, whoever heard of it, hadn't yet occurred. Gives you something of the time frame. I will now read what is said here. My first sermon, Mr. Armstrong had read Exodus 31, and he did feel impelled to present something on this chapter about the Sabbath as a separate covenant with Israel before the church brethren. And we had come to know and to love them. This was in the Willamette Valley. Repeatedly they had urged me to preach for them. Now, to ask him to speak is the same as to say they had no resident pastor. They had no resident pastor. Some of these people had been here years before. Many of them had been migrating out from Oklahoma and Missouri, and more were to come when the Great Dust Bowl developed in, let's say, 1931, I believe it was, and then there was relief the next year, and then 33, 4, 5, 6, 7, and probably even 38. It was very bad in all those years. Now, however, I was overcome with an urge to get this new knowledge before them and was unable to refuse any longer to speak. It was arranged for me to speak on the following Sabbath. The meeting was held in a country store building. We drove first for lunch to the farm home of one of the members south of Salem, Oregon, the capital, near Jefferson. We were taken down to the Runcorn family, by the Runcorn family of Salem. Who we now had begun to look upon as sort of second parents. It was Mrs. Runcorn who opened my wife's eyes to the subject of the Sabbath, that is, the truth of the Sabbath. So Mr. Armstrong goes down. The preaching service was held in the afternoon. Suddenly, the terrifying realization dawned on my mind that I might be called on to give thanks over the food at the luncheon before the sermon. I realized it would be customary to call on a visiting guest. I had never prayed aloud before others. The thought of doing so frightened me, but by this time I had gone far enough in my Christian experience and study of the Bible to know what to do. I began praying silently as we rode along, that if called upon, God would put the words in my mouth and give me the help that I needed. The fear loosened its grip. I had been learning the lesson of faith. I knew that Christ would be with me and not forsake me, and all embarrassment over the anticipation left. Sure enough, I was called on to ask the blessing over the food. I did have the help I needed. I don't believe that any there except Mrs. Armstrong knew this was my first audible prayer in the presence of others, until I told some of them afterward. The meeting itself was held in a vacant country store building nearby. It was known as the Old Deaver Store. This meeting, I believe, he says, was in the summer of 1928. If that talk I gave explaining this Sabbath covenant could be called a sermon, it was my first. Mrs. Armstrong assured me it was far from being a powerful sermon, yet it was enthusiastically received. I did have a message and a sincere, earnest urge to present it. That's the background of how Mr. Armstrong first began formally to speak by invitation of the brethren in the Willamette Valley. We'll move along now to page 367, paragraphs 2 to 4. My first regular preaching. As soon as I had heard of a person named Mr. Hobbs and a little group at Oregon City, I had visited him a few days after my first sermon. I found a very small group of brethren who met together in a little church building at the top of the hill on the Molalla Road in Oregon City outside of Portland. If you understand the next paragraph, you will understand why they were not among the larger noted people, this organization. There were only around 8 to 12 of them, but they habitually met on Sabbath afternoons to study the Sabbath school lesson using the quarterlies from the Stanberry Publishing House. So on discovering in paragraph, now let me make a statement. Yeah, that's paragraph 2 and 3. I will read 4 for the moment. On discovering this little group, I began going to Oregon City to meet with them regularly. Almost immediately, they asked me to be their leader in the study of the lesson. Soon I was delivering them a sermon every Sabbath. You see, this Mr. Hobbs, who had come to Mr. Armstrong's attention, was an 80-year-old active and alert person, and was appreciative of what Mr. Armstrong had said when he heard about what was taking place. And so Mr. Armstrong began to meet near Portland with a group of the brethren and began speaking there every Sabbath. You can fill in some of the details in between. For some time, Mr. Armstrong's articles now continued to appear on the front page of the Bible Advocate. So you see how things were slowly progressing. We haven't come to the crisis of 1929 in the nation yet. Everything seemed positive, but even in such a positive world, the churches of God were so small. We'll move now past the beginning of the Depression, late 1929, and into 1930. There is a subhead on page 409 that I would like to read. Mr. Armstrong was at a meeting. Page 409 is a subhead, the near fight at a meeting. Along in November of 1930, the Runcorns, neighbors of my parents, because Mr. Armstrong's parents had moved out, asked me to go with them to a business meeting of the Brethren of the Church of God being held in the home of Mrs. Ira Curtis near Jefferson, Oregon. That's further south. Although I was a guest, I had never become a member of the church whose headquarters was at Stanbury, Missouri. They nevertheless asked me to act as secretary and to take down the minutes of the meeting. I learned that the meeting was called for the purpose of organizing these Oregon members into an Oregon conference. Now, for a church to have someone preach to a local group, and really they had no organization and therefore made no reference to any files as to whether Mr. Armstrong had formally been accepted as a member or not, that gives you some idea of the level of their knowledge of organization. I sensed a meeting. Immediately, there was a feeling of division among them. Elder A.N. Duggar was the real leader of the church at Stanbury. He was editor of the church's weekly paper, sent to members. He either was or had been president of their general conference. I learned that they were organized as a general conference with the election of officers, held biannually. Most of the Oregon members lived in the Willamette Valley, in the vicinity of Jefferson. Most of them were in attendance at this business meeting. About half were opposed to Elder Duggar. They wanted to organize a state conference. Some of the other state conferences, other states had state conferences. The purpose of this Oregon State Conference was to hold the tithes and church funds contributed by Oregon members in Oregon, and then they would donate as the conference decided, instead of members sending the money directly to Stanbury. Actually, it was born of opposition to and dissatisfaction with the Stanbury membership and state conference. That's centered in Stanbury, Missouri. The other half were just as verbal in their loyalty and support of Elder Duggar and Stanbury. So there was essentially a division taking place within the church, November 1930, and it led to a split in the church in 1931. The dispute over Stanbury politics and Elder Duggar's personal fitness and integrity waxed more and more heated. And then there were some serious problems, and Mr. Armstrong interrupted. Brethren, I said, you all know how, as recorded in the first chapter of Job, when the sons of God came together, Satan came also. You also know how in the 12th chapter we're told that the people of God, Satan is angry with, he would not write this way, he was quoting himself, are those who keep the commandments and who have the testimony of Jesus Christ. This means us. Satan is here, he is stirring up anger in your hearts. I'm going to drop to my knees right now and ask God Almighty to cast Satan out of this house. All of you who wish may kneel with me and pray silently. Without another word, I dropped to my knees beside my chair and began asking God to rebuke the devil and this controversial spirit that was arousing these men to anger and to give us peace and love. When I arose, there were some wet eyes. There were no angry voices. These people were sincere. They simply believed what they believed and had allowed themselves to be caught off guard and aroused to anger. The result, of course, is discussed on page 411. Asked to conduct a campaign. The state conference in Oregon was agreed to and formed. The concept of church government seemed to be that lay members should be in the offices of authority. Ministers were to be employed and under orders from the lay members. This is essentially the concept of what we call democracy. But that's the way the Oregon Conference came to be organized. That is the, you note, the people wanted to get something done. They wanted to be able to have enough funding to do things in Oregon that weren't being done. Now, what was being done from headquarters, significantly, of course, was publishing. But there was no clear development of the ministry at that time in the area of Oregon. I believe top of page 412, paragraph 1, I'll just fill this in for the moment. I believe that elderly G.A. Hobbs of Oregon City was made the first president, that O.J. Runcorn was president the second year. And he had certain information in his files, which we now have in connection with the college library. Anyway, this is the story now of what is happening in December 1930. The organization began to take shape, and soon we come to 1931. Page 414, paragraph 1. After Mr. Armstrong had been involved in serving the brethren, working with them, being a secretary when the Oregon Conference was formed, something happened. The brethren asked Mr. Armstrong to speak. But Mr. Armstrong now asked them to do something. He says, their tempers would not have boiled over in the near fight if I had not prayed and taken action. But as I had been too embarrassed to refuse their offer, which was now to speak, they were too embarrassed to refuse my offer that they should pray for him. So Mr. Armstrong said, if you want me to speak, and I agreed to, and I want you to pray that what will be said in a campaign here will be of some value to the community. To refuse to devote an hour a day on their knees would be very unchristian. Yes, that would have been more embarrassing than to go through with it for them. So they agreed. They pledged themselves to this intensive prayer. I agreed. I was brought one step closer to the ministry of Christ. These brethren realized that the Stanbury Church, I'm moving from paragraph 1 to 2 to 3, 4, there are little short ones here, was not getting the gospel to the world with power. In this area, the church was virtually impotent. The Oregon brethren were anxious to get the work going. Although I had been greatly humbled by business reverses not of my making and by conversion, they were aware of my past experience in the business world. Paragraph 5, and from the time of this business meeting, the brethren in Oregon looked to me for the leadership that would revitalize the work of the gospel in Oregon. There had been no minister of the church resident in Oregon. And from this time, ministers were to be sent, or but from this time, there to counteract the favor these brethren were showing toward me. Now, no sooner had it become apparent to the church who were not ordained to baptize, and we put men in training sometimes who give sermonettes. That's our present structure before the sermon. Anyway, that's the background as it moves along in the story. And it is important to take note of how Mr. Armstrong came to speak publicly. The first public preaching is discussed on the bottom of page 414. I will not go into the details there. We'll move now to another matter. On page 416 to page 417 is a section about who should baptize the people who were being converted as a result of the public campaigns, or in this case, campaign, singular. The subject of water baptism had been the very first I had studied in the Bible after my original surrender to Christ. Now I had four new converts to be baptized, one of them my own brother, Dwight Armstrong. But who was to baptize them? I was not an ordained minister. A young minister of the Church of God who was sent from Stanbury headquarters had been in an automobile accident in Harrisburg, confined to a bed in the hospital as a result, and he and Mr. Armstrong got together, and it was quite apparent from the account in Matthew 28, that those who did the speaking, as Philip in Acts 8, the apostles in Acts 2, that whether a deacon, whether a minister, those who led an individual through public speaking or otherwise in that nature to come to conversion would have baptized the individual. That was the conclusion. So the minister agreed, and Mr. Armstrong recognized that there are examples of that nature. Now today, normally, ministers do. But we have never recognized in the church that ministers alone may do so. But there should be someone so designated and sent for that purpose, and when someone is speaking and having a campaign and there is no one ordained, there was no reason why this should not have been done. So he baptized them. This brought stern criticism from the authorities in the church at Stanbury. There was criticism because the conference paid expenses when I was not even a member. In fact, all this time I was to meet continual criticism, but the lay members looked more and more to me for leadership in the Oregon Conference. Page 418, paragraph 1. The year was 1931, and now we come to an interesting turn of events. On page 418, Mr. Armstrong gives a summary of his ordination in the first paragraph. Now, there'll be much more about that later, but there is the summary. This was the year that he was ordained. It was one of the most economically lean years in the country. It was the first year of the Great Drought, the Dust Bowl. So Mr. Armstrong was plunged full-time into the ministry, yet this very ordination was to foment multiplied opposition from the Stanbury ministry. We move now from page 418 to 425. This is the story of a former Seventh-day Adventist minister, a Robert L. Taylor, who came to Oregon from California. It was a practice among the people of the Church of God to hold all-day meetings once a month. It was at one of these meetings that Mr. Taylor preached, and everyone was impressed. He's a better preacher than any of the leading ministers from Stanbury, seemed to be the common exclamation. Indeed, we were all swept off our feet by his preaching. After a few weeks, the brethren of the Oregon Conference wanted to team Elder Taylor with me to hold an evangelistic campaign. They were becoming anxious to see a little life in the work of the church. Now, that's the story here on 325 under the subhead. No paragraphs in particular, it's just under the subhead. That's background. 426. On page 426, paragraph 3. Being ordained and entering the ministry full-time, ordained by the elders in the Oregon Conference, meant a complete change in my life. In former years, the idea of becoming a minister was the last thing I had wanted to do. But by June of 1931, somewhere around Pentecost, I had been preaching a great deal for 3.5 years. In other words, from early 1928 to the summer of 1931. And by this time, my whole heart was in it. Now, to have accepted ordination of the Oregon Conference of the Church of God cannot be construed in any other manner but to have accepted membership within the Oregon Conference of the Church of God. That is, we have to recognize that there is no doubt that when Mr. Armstrong was asked, the brethren accepted him as a genuine member and speaker and leader, and he accepted ordination from them, which means to accept the authority of the Oregon Conference of the Church of God. The last line of page 426 on to 427. It was decided by the officers of the conference that on the next all-day meeting I was to be ordained. Now, you see, he's writing to the audience in the magazine, and so he starts out with a generality. Now he gives the details. This is the story of what really went on step by step. I shall never forget that moment of my ordination, paragraph 1 of page 427, and then he tells the story of what it was like emotionally to be ordained to a responsibility of this nature. I was ordained, and this will be 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, this is the 7th paragraph on 427. I was ordained by and under the authority of the Oregon Conference of the Church of God, separately incorporated, not by the Stanbury, Missouri headquarters, but the state conferences had authority due to do so. That was the way it was organized at the time. Very important paragraph. Paragraph 7, page 427. 437, paragraph 3. It was planned that I was to leave Eugene and put on a campaign in St. Helens, Oregon, 25 miles north of Portland, with a minister of the name Roy Daly, who had just returned from Stanbury and other points in the Midwest. The conference had just employed him. There were now 3 of us on the payroll at $20 per week. You know, this is the period when some people think money wasn't worth much, who've never lived through it. No, this was the time when money was worth a great deal. So much so that you could do a week's work and get $20. And bread was 10 cents a loaf. And eggs, smaller size, grade 2 or 3, were a penny apiece. Now that means that money bought something. How would you like to spend a penny for one egg today? That gives you some idea of what has happened. Mr. Armstrong said, at this rate, the conference treasury was soon going to be empty. But Elder Taylor was to remain in Eugene, superintending a new building. Many events were to take place in that little church building, which is the one that Mr. Armstrong referred to later on as the church on West 8th Street, where the meetings were held for years, the church Sabbath meetings. So 437 gives us the beginning of his accepting a salary and in the employment as a minister and member of the Oregon Conference of the Church of God Seventh Day. On 444, we'll move along now, page 444. There are a number of paragraphs above the subhead. These are only to keep track of minor events along the way, but so that you will learn how certain events turned out. The last paragraph above the subhead, page 444. There was a special business meeting to be scheduled, but it was called off. Later, it was determined that Elder Daly and Mr. Armstrong were to be laid off, and Elder Taylor was kept on. So it was quite clear that if Mr. Armstrong was to continue, there had to be some other source of income. We don't need to go through those details. Mr. Armstrong tells, of course, of what it was like to be out of the ministry for a while as a result of being in the newspaper business. But this was the Depression, and there were some very serious problems economically all over the country, not excluding Oregon, although the diversity of crops in Oregon made it possible to survive better than in some monocrop areas. 446, the bottom of the page. I remember distinctly the all-night bus ride back to the valley from eastern Oregon. Arriving home at East State Street in Salem, I learned that the state conference board had run low on funds and unable to continue paying three salaries, each of 20 per week, had decided to retain Mr. Taylor and release Elder Daly and me until funds revived. So what happened was there was to be a meeting that didn't occur. Mr. Armstrong says what he learned about the meeting. Then he tells of other things in his own life and then mentions how formally he had learned of the details. Remember, this is the autobiography of Herbert Armstrong, not the story of the function and the work of the Church of God. That's why sometimes he will introduce the subject in summary and then tell the details when it fit into how he described his own life experience. That was indeed a blow. So he went back into advertising, page 448. Just wanted to mention that, page 448. Went back into advertising, and from 448 we go all the way to 482. That's the story of his period of time back into the business world. Now, 482, a new salary, is described. And this is paragraph 1. One day, late in February 1933, Mike Helms drove his pickup truck to our house. He had come to take us back to the valley. The church conference had now accumulated a small balance. Mike was now president of the conference. He said he would be able to pay us $3 a week. But you know, to accumulate enough money so you could pay $3 a week shows you what was happening. Herbert Hoover thought the Depression would be over right away. Well, it really wasn't seen as a depression. You see, they used to call it boom and bust. And they tried to call it a depression. You know, if you can see what I'm doing, there's water in a glass and then a little paper above it. And a depression was just a dent, you see. And that's what it was supposed to be, just a small dent, a depression. That was to obscure the fact there might be a problem, if you could just call it a depression. But when the depression became the depression, now we had to invent another word. We call it a recession. That is, we just slightly move back. Not like we're knocked over, but that's usually what happens. So all these economic terms are invented to cloud the meaning. 482. Mr. Armstrong is now invited back at $3 a week by the Oregon Conference. The newspaper didn't last more than about 2 months after he left. He had promised to help them, and then he stayed on and on and on. That was probably one of his most remarkable years that he regretted, in the sense of having taken a detour, and he tells about it. We move now to page 507. On page 507, after the photographs here, organizing another church. On page 507, we'll start at the top of the page, one, paragraph one, right at the beginning. I was still in the employ of the Oregon Conference of the Church of God. The salary was $3 a week. The conference was to have paid our house rent in Salem, and they supplied us with bulk food. Whole wheat flour, raw sugar, and beans. And Mr. Armstrong was never in love with those beans. I remember him telling that when he wrote this. Farmer members supplied us with vegetables and fruits. However, part of the time the conference was unable to pay our house rent, which was $7 a month. Any of you would like to find a place to rent at $7 a month in Pasadena? No one. I mean, where are all your hands? this is remarkable, isn't it? Now you think, just think of it. $7 got you a place to rent. You say that the dollar had no value in those days? Why, that could keep you with shelter for a month. What a remarkable change has taken place. Now it's $700. In many places of Pasadena, and then there are those of you who wish to pay more. I should perhaps edit that. You're required to. You have no choice. My wife had to make up the deficit by doing the washing for our landlady. In addition to this, I raised the vegetable garden on our lot that summer. Now, I can guarantee you, as far as I know, this is the only time he ever had a vegetable garden. That's why he mentions it. Mr. Armstrong was not a farmer at heart. He has a picture of himself on the family farm. And he looks like he came from downtown Chicago and simply put on the clothes. I mean, a farmer doesn't stand like he stood in that picture. He's not a part of it. He's only in it. But his training, his whole life experience was different. But I knew enough as he was writing, he would make comments that it wasn't that every summer he had a vegetable garden. This was of necessity. And when there was no necessity, there was no vegetable garden. There were other things to be done. So this gives us some background on page 506. Of the development. I won't read further now what was taking place, but we'll start on the bottom of 507, the start of the present work, under the new subhead, 507. As soon as arrangements were completed for starting the new church at Salem, I hurried on down to the Fisher Farm to start the new campaign west of Eugene. This campaign was at the Fir Butte School. I had the chance this last year for the first time to drive in the area and become acquainted with the street names and the old buildings where the meetings were held. I had never had the chance to do that before. It is a remarkable area. It has hardly changed since the Great Depression because it was a developed small farm. And the people who live there are still adequately prosperous. It was good soil, good water. So we have the campaigns beginning. Mr. Armstrong explains them, but they're not to the point of our concern right now. That's, in a sense, the beginning of the present work. The Fir Butte School, 1933. Now, page 518. A question arose over the matter of pork. Not between Mr. Armstrong and the Bible, but between the members of the ministers of the Church of God Seventh Day, and whether members needed to know about pork before they were baptized. The answer, of course, is that Mr. Armstrong felt that many of these subjects needed to be taught after baptism, not before, just like people need the help of the Spirit of God to overcome smoking. You didn't have to quit smoking before you were baptized. But you had to be in a repentant state of mind. On page 420, I had not mentioned before, but in April 1933, bottom paragraph, 420, during the Salem meetings, I had started the issuing of a monthly bulletin for members of the conference. It was mimeographed. I had hired the bulletin printed at a local mimeograph shop. The bulletin ultimately became the good news. So while a minister and a member of the Oregon Conference of the Church of God, in April 1933, the bulletin began to be published, giving the members the knowledge of what the Oregon Conference was doing. I think that's an important point to bear in mind. We will move along now to page 422. The fact remains that in this period here, Mr. Armstrong was working with the conference. The monies of the conference were used to pay for the bulletin. That's the top of 421. The monies of the conference paid for the bulletin, announcing what was to happen. On 422, there was a business meeting at the Harrisburg School. A number of ministers were there, and a serious problem was gradually developing. There was a Mr. Ray and Mr. Oberg, and others were involved in an all-day wrangle. I knew they had swayed some of the brethren to believing I had done wrong in baptizing the people. That goes back to that earlier campaign. I was allowed to defend myself, and so Mr. Armstrong explains all the problems that arose at that time. Now, 524. As soon as I had finished with the explanations, Mr. Fisher's car had arrived to take me back to the Fir Butte School for the evening meeting of the public campaign. I was forced to leave immediately. I had asked the board members and ministers if they would postpone any action until another meeting when I could be present. To this, they had agreed. This was on some of these picky little points. About half the brethren present were plainly on my side. I left the church building. This half arose and walked out to assure me of their sympathy and that they would resist any action against him for baptizing somebody before they had quit eating pork, before they had known all these things. Mr. Armstrong had baptized them. As soon as I and all who were in support of me had gone outside, Messrs. Ray and Oberg broke their word. They immediately offered a resolution that I be required, if I remained in the conference, to baptize people their way. Now, 524, this is actually paragraph 1, 2, and 3, a very important paragraph. And those remaining inside the church building were swayed into voting for it. The next paragraph, 4. As soon as I heard of the action taken, I immediately wrote a letter canceling the $3 per week salary, suggesting they give it to Messrs. Oberg and Ray. I did not resign from the conference. I refused further salary. And he kept on doing the work that the Oregon Conference had asked. Let those who have decided on their own to be competitive and to leave the work take note of paragraph 4 on the bottom of page 524. This was in 1933. Then Mr. Armstrong on the top of the next page said what it meant to trust God as an employer. Some people might have thought it was a great deal of courage, but it wasn't. It really wasn't that much, and he had to have so many other supplements. So what he gave up was really minimal. At least now he was free to baptize and to administer the responsibility that the Oregon Conference still left him with, without having that salary. He was now in a much stronger position to speak, because it's not like saying, well, in this case, I can't do this or I can't do that because I have a salary. The fact remains that the church simply had a basic policy that was wrong, of requiring people to learn all sorts of things over weeks or months before they would be baptized. That became an issue. And Mr. Armstrong was not under the authority of the headquarters in Stanbury, Missouri. And they tried to impose this on him through the Oregon Conference, which was equally divided. And they did it by breaking their word not to address the question and have a discussion when he had stepped outside because of the requirement of that evening meeting, and to carry on at a later occasion this discussion. He was not adverse to a discussion or a working out of the problem. Page 426 tells the story then of how the campaigns began to develop further, that continued the work being done through the little congregations at Fir Butte, Eugene, and so forth. Now, 529. The first broadcast was on August 1933, and Mr. Armstrong had been invited to speak on radio with other ministers. You should remember that, but I will just cite it here. 529, the first broadcast. Not of the World Tomorrow or the Radio Church of God program, but just speaking, excuse me, on radio, where a certain time was available to the various ministers in and around Eugene. We'll move from this then to page 555. On 555, we have paragraph 4, under a subhead. During these late winter and spring months of early 1934, the opposition of Elders Ray and Oberg did not cease. I had rejected the $3 a week salary from the Oregon Conference after the all-day wrangle in August 1933. But this alone did not stop the problem. At the biennial conference top of 556, we have the story of what was taking place in Stanbury, Missouri, that Elder Duggar had lost his previous control by one vote. That is, the church was nearly evenly divided on many points. Mr. Duggar promptly bolted the conference and organized a Church of God out of Salem, West Virginia. I'm mentioning that. This Church of God, under Mr. Duggar's leadership, chose Mr. Armstrong to be one of 70 elders. His name is listed in the Old History of the Church of God, published by Duggar and Dodd. So whereas within the Stanberry group, Mr. Armstrong was subject to and a part of the Oregon Conference, when this church at the headquarters split, Mr. Armstrong was named as one of the 70 elders of the Church of God Seventh Day, Salem, West Virginia, versus the Church of God Seventh Day, Stanberry, Missouri. So much for that. And all this is a lengthy discussion, and I will say, if you'd like the details, from the top of 556 to the bottom of 558. The subhead nearly at the bottom is the entire story of how his relationship continued through 34, 35, 36, and into 37, trying to cooperate with the former leadership of the Church of God Seventh Day under A.N. Duggar. Now, Mr. Armstrong attempted to cooperate with him. That was the best way to put it. A new organization was formed. Mr. Armstrong did not say, we don't want to have anything to do with it. He simply tried to cooperate as long as it was possible, even if the Oregon Conference went with Stanberry. Now we will move to page 561, almost finished here, paragraph 4. Mr. Armstrong mentions at a certain time that he had learned indeed, not just by word, but by fact, that he was considered one of the 70 elders or ministers in the church. A.N. Duggar was the deacon, not an apostle. He had, used his function as a deacon in this case to control the purse strings, which gave him authority over all the ministry in that organization centered in Salem. Now, he says in paragraph 5, that he regularly turned in reports. Thus we of the Church of God, meeting at the Jean Schoolhouse, along with our brethren, paragraph 6, of the Oregon Conference, decided to go along with what Mr. Duggar had organized in Salem, and in cooperation. But we of the new local church at Eugene, or near Eugene, did not join in the sense of becoming an integral part of it. That is, the groups of people he was raising up functioned on their own, beginning to do the separate broadcast, continuing to publish the bulletin of the Oregon Conference, and cooperating with the headquarters in Salem, West Virginia, even if other members of the Oregon Conference proposed to cooperate with the headquarters in Stanberry. I had begun to send in regular ministers' reports, paragraph 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 now. I did not accept salary or expense money from them, nor in our local church no one put himself under their authority. We kept ourselves free to obey God as set forth in the Scriptures, should any differences come up. And they did later come up. And now, page 632, right near the end of the volume. There was a meeting that was to be held I'm going to have you read 632, paragraph 5. This particular camp meeting was the last of our cooperation with the Salem, West Virginia branch of the church. There was a meeting that Mr. Armstrong had announced on radio, and various people were invited, and the people from Salem, West Virginia also came. Their purpose was, in fact, to attack the work in a meeting that Mr. Armstrong was responsible for having organized. The ministers who came from Salem began to speak about dear Brother Armstrong, who had worked so hard and was so overworked that they decided to help me by relieving me of some of my burdens. They had decided to appoint another of their ministers, one totally hostile to me, as pastor of the church at Jefferson, which he had not raised up. So they had that perfect right. And he almost wept crocodile tears of pretended sympathy. His purpose was, of course, to keep all the money of the Jefferson Brethren in the function of the new Salem Church of God Seventh-day at Salem, West Virginia. One elder and one deacon of the Jefferson Church, shocked and thoroughly aroused at this so evident subterfuge and bit of deceitful hypocrisy as a plot to take over that church and just rob the broadcast of, and thus rob the broadcast of its tithes and offerings, resigned immediately from their contact with the Church of God Seventh-day at Salem, West Virginia. Those people included Mr. Henyon. The Brethren still met at Jefferson. This is, you see, the period of 1937. I met in 1950 and 51 at Salem. The Brethren were still there. To say that the Church of God broke and left, I should say that the Worldwide Church of God or the Radio Church of God or Mr. Armstrong left, that simply would be a mistake. The membership even stayed there and fellowshipped. I was invited to speak one day after graduating from Ambassador College in 1951 at the same congregational meeting place at Scrabble Hill in Jefferson. So the members continued to abide there in their fellowship. The tithes and offerings went to continue to support the work that the Oregon Conference had been doing. They severed ties with the Salem, West Virginia group. And we have a situation in which there was a headquarters in Salem, in which there was a headquarters in Stanbury, Missouri, and now there was a whole new lively work beginning in Eugene. Already having begun, let me say, but it was really only beginning in one sense of the word as far as what was to happen. Top of page 635, all of us at Eugene Church and half of the members at Jefferson severed all connection and effort to cooperate with those who had proved themselves willing to be the tools of the devil. That's what it was, sadly. I had a chance to meet with, though I did not speak, with the Church of God Seventh-day, Salem, Stanbury, Missouri, under Mr. Ray Oberg in Eugene. It was not uncommon for them to ask us from Ambassador College to meet with them. We worked there during the summer. Sometimes we spoke at our own congregation in Portland or Eugene. The other part of the Sabbath day, morning or afternoon, we might either be in Jefferson or Eugene, Oregon. So there was a general fellowship. When possible, in those areas, that's simply the way the work was. Mr. A.N. Duggar spoke down here. Mr. Armstrong felt that the membership should listen to him. So in the early 1950s, there was a meeting in which many heard Mr. Duggar here in Southern California. I've gone over time, but I think this is very important, and you should go over this at your convenience to check the notes and the information so that you understand why it is that those who have come and gone have not done the same thing that this work did at the beginning. And to claim so is the same as to say they have never read the evidence that is in the autobiography of Herbert W. Armstrong.